Good afternoon. Let's start. I'm very happy to welcome Professor Beatrix Busse from the University of Heidelberg, who's going to give us a guest lecture. You can see the title already on the screen here. Just a bit of background information. Beatrix Busse studied at Osnabrück, and she then went on to work for some years at Münster. She also worked as an associate professor in Bern, where she also got her Habilitation. And since early 2011, she's been a professor of English linguistics at the University of Heidelberg. She's a specialist in the history of English, that's why I invited her. Her fields of interest are quite wide. If you look at her homepage, then it's sort of a long list of things, including stylistics. I guess that's a really prominent one. Corpus linguistics as a methodology. It's another reason why I invited her. Also the language of Shakespeare. And of course also historical pragmatics. And that's the main reason why she's here today, because, as you know, we had lectures on, I don't know, syntax, morphology, on semantics, etc., etc. And she's taking the lecture on pragmatics, on issues to do with, well, expressions of attitude in the history of English. And I won't say more, I'll just hand over to you. I'm very happy to have you here. And she'll talk for about, I don't know,
we'll see.
And anyone who asks an intelligent question afterwards gets 10 extra points for the exam or something like that. Shall we do that? No, there will be question time afterwards, and it would be good if some of you could ask a few questions. Okay.
Thank you, Sebastian. Thank you for the kind introduction and also for the invitation to Trier. I'm happy to be here. I'll start with some examples first. So upon reading these expressions highlighted here, you might well be reminded of the present-day English use of adverbs which indicate a speaker's attitude or opinion. Forsooth, a great arithmetician, and indeed such a fellow, to say precisely, were not for the court, for by my troth, they have as well deserved it as any man that ever bare live. Now, all of these expressions indicate, as you'll see later, some are historical, some of them we still use today, indicate some kind of attitude or opinion by the speaker, or reinforce what the speaker would like to stress. What I have in mind for today, I'd like to illustrate to you how I set up an historically informed inventory of stance adverbials in early modern English, and my choice of stance adverbials then is already referring to a terminology by Biber and others, as you'll see later on as well. I'd like to analyze their syntactic realizations and semantic categories. I'd like to establish frequencies, as well as I like to determine variation and or stability across text types and genres, but only for two particular types, because it takes some time to collect all these examples. And then I like to illustrate the function of stance adverbials in context, also drawing on historical pragmatic methodology, as well as a theoretical approach. And then I'd also like to identify and show you what the methodological challenges were when trying to collect a set of stance adverbials in the history of English. So just my introduction or my outline, I'll start with an introduction, obviously. Then I try to define stance adverbials. I'll show you the methodological challenges, and then you'll see stance adverbials in a corpus of Shakespeare's plays. Professor Hoffmann has just said that Shakespeare is one of my areas of interest, so I started actually with Shakespeare's plays when I identified or tried to identify stance adverbials as such. Forms, frequencies, and functions. But before I do that, let me talk a little bit about historical pragmatics and also recent trends in what Christian Meyer, who will be here today as well later on at 6 o'clock, as I've heard, has called modern historical linguistics. I think that these or new approaches to historical data then tell also new stories about socio-pragmatic and sometimes even cognitive linguistic phenomena that have changed or remained stable in the course of, in our case, the history of English. Sometimes these findings are bridged with more classic historical linguistic areas such as historical phonology, historical morphology, or historical syntax. More specifically, both the fields of historical pragmatics and historical sociolinguistics have made significant contributions to explaining socio-pragmatic features of language use in the past. And they have also furthered our understanding of research methods and data analysis, and also therefore have revealed their potentials for the analysis of contemporary language data. Within this framework, then, historical corpus analysis and corpus linguistics as such cannot be underestimated. The refinement of corpus tools and search procedures, as well as the availability, I was going to say, of more and easily accessible historical data have led diachronic text analysis or mining into new and highly delicate analytical directions. So there's more data for us to investigate, for example, pragmatic features or aspects of style. And we can do that on a much broader and diachronic scale than used to be possible, for example, even 20 years ago, when the field of historical pragmatics in the 1990s started. In addition, these historical pragmatic and historical sociolinguistic approaches have been better, I think, at considering literary sources, literary, to be indispensable for the study of older stages of language than linguistic approaches with deal with present-day language data. And this is, although here are exceptions in the room, Mike Stubbs, of course, has worked with literary data. So this is not only because due to the non-existence of spoken records for historical periods, but in historical investigations, we have to draw on so-called literary data in order to have something like or which represents spoken data as such. As such, they have probably followed Sinclair, who does not marginalize the study of literature for the analysis of linguistic features. On the contrary, he stresses, and now I quote, no systematic apparatus can claim to describe a language if it does not embrace the literature also, and not as a freakish development, but as a natural specialization of categories which are required in other parts of the descriptive system. And this is my stylistic base here, which in an article I've called New Historical Stylistics. Of course, due to these new and fruitful trends, there are also complex challenges involved. In historical pragmatics, they include, for example, a rediscussion of the relationship between a function to form and a form to function mapping. Can I just ask, Sebastian, have you talked about function to form to function?
Not in this section. No.
Okay, so in historical pragmatics, you've got two different approaches, if you like. Pragma philology, which investigates pragmatic features at a particular point in time in the distant past. So you analyze Shakespeare's language, for example. And then there's diachronic pragmatics, which tries to investigate pragmatic features in the course of time. And there are two different mappings, as Jacobs and Jucker have established them, the form-to-function mapping and the function-to-form mapping. So you can start with a form, for example, well, and then you can try to investigate how well, for example, developed into a discourse marker. You can also start with a function, for example, speech acts, an expressive speech act, and then see how this expressive speech act has been realized in the course of the history or in the course of the development of the English language. So function to form and form to function mapping. Now, with regard to these new challenge, or with regard to these the amount of data we've got now and new findings in modern linguistics as well, there are new challenges involved for, of course, historical data analysis as well. So we can ask the question, how much context is actually needed in order to infer socio-pragmatic meanings in historical texts? Or what is the relationship between low and high frequency items, or the question of whether we actually always need quantitative procedures to trace historical pragmatic change? That's something we can discuss later. Let me now try to define stance expressions. Stance adverbials indicate a speaker's attitude or opinion. They can be defined as sentence modifiers with sentential scope, which are not grammatically required but may be pragmatically desired, and are speaker or hearer oriented. Here are some examples. And indeed, such a fellow to say precisely, you've seen that, were not for the court or for by my troth. You don't need these highlighted elements here for a grammatical sentence, but of course, they have pragmatic meaning. The position stance adverbials can take on in the clause is flexible amongst initial, medial, or final position, and they can be realized not only by adverbs, but also by a variety of other syntactic structures, such as prepositional phrases, finite clauses, non-finite clauses, and noun phrases. And you'll see that later on. Biber and others label these examples stance adverbials, yeah? Which may simultaneously function as an indication of the speaker's comment on what they are saying, the content of the message, and how they are saying it. They also, Biber et al., and this is an analysis of modern, or this categorization they have established is based on modern English, but I try to transfer this to historical data. They set up a semantic classification of stance adverbials, and following their analyses of stance adverbials in present-day English conversation, fiction, newspapers, and academic English, they established three broad categories of stance adverbials, which you've got here. So you've got epistemic, now you can't hear me, epistemic, attitudinal, and stylistic stance adverbials, and the epistemic stance adverbials have further subcategories: doubt and certainty, actuality, reality, viewpoint, and imprecision. These are broad, but keep the broad semantic categories in mind for the moment. That's the most important thing. Examples of epistemic stance adverbials are, for example, are indeed, or in regard of, indicating viewpoint. Attitudinal stance adverbials express the speaker's attitude towards an evaluation, as in happily, for example. And stance adverbials of style convey a speaker's style and often clarify how the speaker is speaking or how the utterance should be understood. Remember this example, to speak properly, freely, or to say precisely. According to Biber et al., grammatical stance devices fulfill two distinct roles simultaneously, that of presenting the stance and that of realizing a proposition that is framed by the stance. For example, coming back here, and indeed such a fellow to say precisely were not for the court, this frames the proposition were not for the court and underlines in initial position the truth of what is claimed in the proposition. However, I have to stress now already that the categories may be rather fuzzy as well, so it's not always easy to decide whether we have got an epistemic stance adverbial or a style adverbial. So that was sometimes difficult, but I guess that's always a problem we have when we try to categorize. Let me talk about some methodological challenges for a moment, to illustrate to you what it takes to set up a set of stanza adverbials in Shakespeare's plays. Now, of course, generally speaking, we always encounter difficulties when dealing with historical texts. And now we're dealing with a pragmatic or pragma-linguistic phenomenon such as stanza adverbials, so that in a way doesn't make our life easier as such. General methodological difficulties evolve around such aspects as diverse as the choice of the copy text, for example, spelling variants. In historical corpora, we have to search for spelling variants, or we have to include spelling variants in order to find all, this is in inverted commas, all instances of a particular form. The wealth of material we have got for a particular period, text production and reception of the analyst functioning, then, or we, or the editors, considering the edition we choose, of, in our case, or in my case, the Shakespeare's plays, the editors always have taken certain decisions, you know, when they edited the text. Now, for stanza adverbials, we have to deal, or what we deal with is a highly discursive phenomenon. Stanza adverbials are realized in a variety of forms, I say prepositional phrases and so on, not just adverbs. And some stanza adverbials used at Shakespeare's time are no longer used as such today. So we can't just choose a set of modern stanza adverbials and search for them in a historical corpus. Then we don't get everything we need. These are important issues we have to remember. So what I did when I worked with stanza adverbials as such, I of course had not just to look at stanza and what has been published on stanza, but also on as phenomena of grammaticalization as such, and as well work by Brinton, for example, on common clauses such as I say, I think, and so on. She has a very interesting book on common clauses where she shows how a common clause like I say, I think, then suddenly becomes a pragmatic marker. So it's not just possible to follow one's present-day English intuition or search for a present-day set of stanza adverbials in a historical text. For example, if you have, or you can see this here in these examples, it cannot be immediately assumed that forms of stanza adverbials used today are relevant to, for example, Shakespeare's English. In Shakespeare's time, for example, apparently still refers to the manner in which something is done, that is, it does not function as an epistemic stanza adverbial of source of knowledge. Something like, apparently, he's a very nice man or a very good student or something like that. Here you've got an example. If he should scorn me so apparently, that's just not a stanza adverbial, which means that if you find these forms in a corpus, of course, you then have to check, do they function as stanza adverbials or not? And in regard of me, in regard of, which would be a stanza adverbial of viewpoint, then here in this example is somewhere in between, doesn't really function as such. It's in regard of me. If you look at me, he shortens 4 years of my son's exile. So that's tricky. And there's another example that's one of my favorite examples where you can see that forms may oscillate or show a semantic layering between their source and the grammaticalized meaning in a particular period under investigation. And these have to be carefully discriminated against one another. So, here, if you have a look at this example, I start with "Hast thou affections?" That's from Antony and Cleopatra. And Cleopatra is moody because Antony had to leave her, and she now wants to be entertained by her eunuch. And therefore, she kind of provokes him by saying, "Hast thou affections?" So, "Hast thou sexual desires?" That's her aim. "Yes, gracious madam, indeed." "Not indeed, madam, for I can do nothing but what indeed is honest to be done. Yet have I fierce affections and think what Venus did with Mars." Even though at the time of Shakespeare's play, or when Shakespeare wrote his plays, indeed was already grammaticalized, you can see how this play, or how the eunuch plays with the two meanings of indeed as such. So we have to be very careful when analyzing these examples. And these are only some of the challenges the historical linguist or pragmatician encounters when systematically investigating a discursal phenomenon like stance adverbials. So you might ask, how did I do, or what did I do, you know, to collect as many forms in an historically informed way? How did I do that? Of course, I checked studies on present-day English stance adverbials. That's what you have to do. You have to do your homework. You have to see and read what has been published in this area. Studies on historical analyses of stance adverbials. Biber has done an investigation of a set of just modern stance adverbials and checked them in the Archer corpus. Studies on grammaticalization, which then also help you to find out which forms were actually used at Shakespeare's times but are no longer used today. And then I also used the material that has been published on Shakespeare's language. For example, Spivak's Thesaurus, a Shakespeare thesaurus. Yeah? So trying to find semantic fields and then the representatives that then illustrate what stance adverbials or what forms of stance adverbials exist. I also consulted, of course, the Oxford English Dictionary, but also early modern English dictionaries, which are now compiled by Ian Lancashire under the heading of Lexicons of Early Modern English. So Ian Lancashire digitized and produced a database of all, and there are quite a few, early modern English dictionaries. And what you can do, unfortunately, you have to have a license for this database, which is a shame in a way because it's pretty expensive. But what you can do is you can search for indeed, for example, and then you find additional forms. Altogether, indeed, truly, certainly, indeed, because, I mean, these are not dictionaries in the modern sense. Usually many of them were bilingual dictionaries or lists of so-called hard words, but nevertheless, you either get the translation or a word that might have meant the same. And this is how I collected additional forms, historically informed forms, for my search. For example, under the heading of Thomas Thomas's dictionary, here, yeah, as you can see, you find a number of, or can you actually see that in the back? Not really. I will read that out to you then again. Without doubt, without fail, utterly. So you get more information because you use the historical sources. Another source I used, and this is another of has turned into my favorite books, is the Historical Thesaurus of the Oxford English Dictionary, which can now be accessed online as well, where you have all the dictionary entries of the Oxford English Dictionary categorized into semantic fields, all of the lemmas. And in addition, it's also a historical thesaurus, which means you can choose either a semantic field and then see how, through the history of English, that semantic field is represented by the different forms. So have a look at that. I think it's an amazing achievement what they have done with the historical thesaurus of the OED. So what I did, for example, I started both ways. I searched for a form, for example, indeed, or truly, or troth, and looked up all the different semantic fields to which troth and truth and truly was allocated. That way, I found different forms as well. I also checked a particular semantic field, like here, assurance, confirmation, guarantee, or faithfulness, trustworthiness, and then you find forms that represent these fields. Not all of them work, but it's a kind of philological way as well to that helps you to set up an inventory of forms. I just think, yeah, that was really useful and helpful. Not all of them appear in Shakespeare, but nevertheless, I had a starting point. In addition, actually, I also read, again, three of Shakespeare's plays, one comedy, one tragedy, and one romance. So I did the real philological works well. Reading can't do any harm, you know, close text analysis, and also underlined or found, retrieved other forms where I thought this is, following my definition, this is a stance adverbia, this might indicate epistemic attitude, for example. So, the corpus of Shakespeare's plays. So I started with one author, not only because I had worked on Shakespeare before, but also it's one author, and some have said that this could be an advantage because it's at least a kind of restricted or a restricted database as such, and not just, as you often have it in corpora, 2,000 words of that text and 2,000 words of another text. I started with that also, and I can admit that here, also because I was very familiar, or I am very familiar with Shakespeare's text. I was able to access the Shakespeare database. Again, that is a database which is not freely available, still not published, but I had access to that. It's a fully lemmatized database of Shakespeare's plays, so I could retrieve some of the forms I had searched for before to see how they were used or what kind of patterns they formed. Now, for my comparisons of some forms, which I'll show you in a minute, I compared the use of indeed in Shakespeare and in the Corpus of English Dialogues, which is a corpus of early modern English spoken or speech-related text from 1560 to 1760, 1.4 million words of early modern English, as I said, speech-related text, and a letter corpus, the past corpus of early English correspondence with 2.2 million words. A letter corpus and another corpus which contains speech-related text, and what Meyer Küto and Jonathan Culpepper, who compiled the CD, have done, they have so-called constructed spoken discourse, comedy, text and didactic text, and on the other hand, more or less natural spoken discourse, because that corpus contains trials and witness depositions. And I thought that would be a good base of comparison, a starting point, to see how the different stance adverbials behave. Now, let's have a look at the distribution of stance adverbials in Shakespeare's plays. And this is, I have to say, this is what I've identified so far in Shakespeare's plays. It consists of, so far, 112 different types of stance adverbials, which are realized by more than 2,000 tokens, which is not that much. It's 26 tokens per 10,000 words. But, nevertheless, they're higher, or they are items which have a higher frequency. But this was the result I got based on the definition of stance adverbials I've shown to you. As this figure illustrates, stance adverbials are most frequently in Shakespeare's comedies, less frequent in the romances, the tragedies, and the history plays. Now, you should be aware of the fact that the categorization, comedies, tragedies, history plays, is a more or less modern categorization as well, at least with regard to the romances. So, but still, I try to follow that as well. Now, I had to try to answer the question why there are more stance adverbials in the comedies, and I'm still not sure whether I'm on the right track there. Somebody suggested to me that one reason for that might be that the comedies contain more prose than verse, and therefore the kind of conversation is more rapid, there's more interaction, quicker interaction, turn-taking, and so on. But unfortunately, that's not the case. The comedies do not contain more prose than verse, so I had to kind of discard that assumption. I'm still, perhaps that's something I have to follow up later on. I would like to relate the use of stanza adverbials to the speakers and their social positions, for example. But I'm just presenting this result to you here. Oops. What's that?
The switch off Bluetooth happens from time to time when someone...
I haven't even...
Yeah, it's someone
using...
trying to play with their mobile phone and trying to connect to you, and stop doing that, please.
Trying to connect to
yes,
me?
Yes, yes. Yes.
Okay. Is that a compliment?
I haven't switched off Bluetooth now. You can do it again, but it'll just be annoying, so please don't.
Okay, I've learned something. Thanks, Sebastian, for telling me, because that has happened to me in Heidelberg as well. Now I know what it is. There are different ways of connecting with me, so... Okay, so more frequently occurring in the comedies. If you have a look, or if you have a look at this table here, these are the most frequently occurring stanza adverbials. You've just absolute numbers here. Indeed, it's the most frequently occurring stanza adverbial: truly, faith, in faith, by my troth, by heaven, perforth, according to, and perhaps. What this table doesn't show is that the construction by my plus a noun, for example, is particularly frequent as well. Many of them are by my troth, but you'll see later on there are other more creative examples as well. So indeed is indeed the most frequently occurring stanza adverbials. Now, if you remember the categorization I presented to you from Biber, epistemic, attitudinal, and style stanza adverbials, you can see that in Shakespeare's plays, epistemic stanza adverbials make up almost, 97% of all the stanza adverbials I was able to identify. Attitudinal stanza adverbials don't occur very often, and it's the same for style adverbials as such. And here you've got a list of the different stanza adverbials and how I try to assign them to the different classes. And again, let me stress, not all of them are clear cut, but I try hard to take account of that. Assuredly, for example, or by my life. Remember, epistemic also had several subclasses. I've left that out now, the different classes as such, because I wanted an overall kind of framework first. Style, then, to speak more properly, in a sort, to say precisely or in brief. And some of them, I think, sound familiar to you from modern English, for example. Now, to some extent, the result for epistemic stanza adverbials in Shakespeare is somewhat similar to findings for present-day English stanza adverbials outlined in Biber et al. They say all of the most common stanza adverbials mark epistemic stanza in modern English. However, the strength of the preference for epistemic stanza in Shakespeare is not reflected in present-day English. There are indeed fewer occurrences of attitudinal and style stanza adverbials in present-day English than there are epistemic stanza adverbials, but the frequencies for the former two semantic categories are much higher. So it's more evenly distributed, even though epistemic stanza adverbials in present-day English are more frequent. Occurring. One reason for the lower frequencies of attitudinal and style adverbials might be that the other uses still had to be developed along the lines of grammaticalization. Also, in modern conversational English, stanza adverbials of style, as I said, are more frequent than attitudinal stanza adverbials. For Shakespeare's plays, However, one of the most important functions of epistemic stance adverbials is to express certainty. So if you have a look at this table again, you can see that it's only on position number 10 where perhaps occurs, which is among the most frequently occurring stance adverbials in present-day English. But apart from that, at least from the semantics of these forms, indeed, truly, faith, and so on, all try to express certainty, which I found was an interesting result. So it's possible to compare modern and early modern English usage, but of course there's a long period in between. But since I didn't have other kind of data to compare it with, I just wanted to present to you some of the kind of tentative comparisons. Now, if we have a look at the syntactic realizations of stance adverbials in Shakespeare, we find that the variety of the syntactic realizations is as broad as for modern English. Among the epistemic forms, for example, we have stance adverbials that contain conjunctions, as I am honest Puck, for example, adverbs indeed and li adverbs certainly, single nouns, faith and sooth, noun phrases, good, sooth, prepositional phrases, by, my, and so on. That's something I will come back to, in faith, or on and upon, and infinitival forms, to say the truth, to say troth, and so on. Among the attitudinal stance adverbials, so far I could only find adverbs. One example is fortunately. And for the style adverbials indicating stance, they have adverbs, such as individual clauses based on verbs of communication, to speak and to say, or prepositional phrases beginning with the preposition in. Now, this would again be a pattern to use, which we could use to search for in other corpora as well. So let me present to you now two case studies of both indeed and by my construction to show you how they behave in Shakespeare and also how they behave in the two other corpora I've mentioned before. As I said, in Shakespeare, indeed is the most frequently occurring stance adverbial with, as you can see, almost 450 occurrences for 5.23 words per 10,000 words. We can see, if we compare that with the use of in the past corpus of early English correspondence here. So in the latter corpus, we can see that for the time when Shakespeare wrote his plays, we have them less, well, we have indeed less frequently occurring. Now, as I said, I also checked that indeed in the corpus of English dialogues. Remember, the spoken corpus with speech-related texts constructed and more or less authentic. And here you can see that in the comedies, drama comedies, there's a higher usage of the stance adverbial indeed than in Shakespeare's plays in general. But it sort of corresponds to the finding, or we could draw the conclusion that indeed occurs frequently in so-called constructed discourse. Now, why can we conclude that? If you have a look at the trials and the witness depositions, indeed doesn't occur very frequently at all. Now, why is that? Why, during a witness deposition, does whoever has something to say, why does this person not use an additional marker to really stress that what he has to say is sincere? Yeah, that's it. Maybe also, that's one, because he has to say the truth and therefore he doesn't need it. That's one explanation. On the other hand, it could be the scribe who just didn't write it down. because you just focus on the essentials. And Meiya Kito elaborate or talks about that perhaps some of only the essentials in a way were written down, or they were written down by scribes, so therefore we've just a transcription basically of what was said, some of the early transcriptions as such. So that could be one reason. If we have a look at the functions of, indeed, I said, I wanted to identify not only the forms, but also the functions of stance adverbials. The person-to-person orientation of the use of indeed in Shakespeare and its social function addressing the speaker is there. You've seen that with the Antony and Cleopatra examples. So one general function is to express the speaker's certainty, right? And in the early modern English dictionaries, you find, for example, indeed, collocating with rightly, truly, as truth is. So you have one example then. Why then, good night, indeed? One passage from Antony and Cleopatra, where Anubarbus converses with Canidius during Antony's fight with Caesar and foreshadows his sincere conviction of Antony's defeat in the finely placed use of indeed. When Edgar, sadly, in King Lear, sadly is forced to acknowledge Lear's death, indeed, in He Is Gone Indeed, the second example, this is more than just a stance adverbial stressing the truth of what is said. It carries almost additive extra-linguistic qualities because it refers to the actual visual process of Lear's wasting away, and therefore also means in reality, in real nature. Or perhaps some of you know this famous passage from Hamlet, where Hamlet accuses his mother of appearance as such, which doesn't have anything to do with realities, with reality. Hamlet uses indeed to cynically elaborate on the discrepancies, as I said, between appearance and reality, which are caused by the marriage between King Claudius and his mother, and the death and murder of his father. And he says, "It's not alone my inky cloak, good mother, nor customary suits of solemn black, these indeed seem, for they are actions that a man might play." So Hamlet's metaphorical description of how appearances of grief cannot really explain what he feels is summarized in this, "these indeed seem." So we can say that indeed is a marker of the spoken, but especially of the constructed spoken discourse, at least when you compare the occurrences in these corpora with one another, the corpora I have used. Some have said, of course, and have labeled, and this is perhaps a problem with the notion of stance adverbials as such, labeled it as a pragmatic marker as well, or a discourse marker, but that's perhaps something we can discuss later on as well. Let me go on with the by my construction, or what I called the by my construction. You've seen that by my troth was more frequent than other constructions in Shakespeare, but you'll see that Shakespeare was a bit more creative when it comes to the by my construction as such. The original preposition by must have had a local sense, and in Middle English it is not certain how far the use of by was native or in how far it was a translation of the French par, indicating instrumentality. And here you've got two examples from Chaucer, by mean had, for example, or by my troth. In Shakespeare's plays, the construction by my, as an epistemic stance adverbial indicating sincerity, as you can see, the anti-construction with all the examples I found has a frequency of 173, not too high, but still it's one of the highest if we think in terms of constructions as such. Now, if you have a look at, or if you compare that with the letter corpus, we can see that, there we go, we can see that the form, the by my construction, most frequently occurs earlier than Shakespeare's plays. Yeah? So here, 1420 to 1499, and then this construction disappears. But it's used in Shakespeare. For the drama corpus, or the corpus of English dialogues as such, we can see a similar kind of development. We have got quite a few instances, and even later than Shakespeare, here for drama and comedy, almost no occurrences for trials and witness depositions, which was striking, might be the same reason. Again, there was no need, either the scribe didn't write it down, or as you said, there was just the task to actually tell the truth, and therefore you don't need these stance adverbials there. To some extent, it seems to be the case, however, it's either the case that for Shakespeare, because we don't have them in the latter corpus, but in the spoken as such, these forms come back, or the construction come back, and you'll see later on how Shakespeare creatively worked with them. That could be one explanation. I still haven't, again, I'm presenting data to you for which I still haven't found all the explanations I need. If we have a look at the kind of creativity that goes with the by my construction, you can see here on this slide that it almost opens up the Shakespearean world, if not the kind of early modern English world picture, because we have something like by my George, by my garter and my crown, whereas by my white beard, by my stay, by my honor, by my will, by my father's leave, by my two faiths and troth, not just one, but two. So there is a kind of creativity involved here, which goes beyond the almost fixed phrases, by my troth and by my faith. Now, you have to know that during the year 1606, there was something like the Profanity Act, an act to restrain abuses of players, which prohibited profanity, or spoken profanity, irreligion, in a dramatic production. So reference to religion through by my troth and by my faith and so on was forbidden. And if you compare, for example, the different editions of Shakespeare's plays, if you compare early quarto editions with the first folio from 1623, you see that exactly these phrases, like by my troth and by my faith, were exchanged. In the 1623 edition, then you find at the same position, at the same place, instead of by my faith, you find truly, to avoid the reference to religion. And perhaps therefore you also have this set of creative elaborations on the construction as such. Okay, perhaps just one example that shows you the force of this construction. By my sword, Beatrix, thou lovest me. That's from Much Ado About Nothing. Perhaps some of you have seen the film with Emma Thompson and Kenneth Branagh, you know, and you know the play, hopefully. They're verbal fencing, and they are continuously, trying to outwit the other, where even though what's all about is their love as such. And then by my sword, Beatrix, thou lovest me, also has some kind of sexual innuendo at the very place, at the very beginning of this utterance. And then do not swear and eat it, and so on. So it goes on and on like that. And here the initial stance adverbial construction by my sword indicates, hopefully, or at that stage, at least in the fourth act, the sincerity or his conviction that Beatrice loves him. Yeah? Okay. So, to conclude, I was a bit faster than I thought, but you'll have plenty of questions, I hope. So, stands, adverbials then in Shakespeare show a wide range of different types as well as syntactic realizations, which turn them into meaning-making, interpersonal, experiential, and textual markers. And when I say experiential, textual, and interpersonal, then I refer to Halliday's grammar, when especially the interpersonal function establishing relationships, indicating in this case that what is said is sincere and honest, plays a crucial role. Stands and experiential, for example, if you've seen, you know, the by my constructions and the different nouns that could follow, garter and so on, by my George, this also refers to typical plays in Shakespeare or of Shakespeare. Garter, the order of the garter, for example, and the Henry plays. Stands, adverbials in general, and epistemic, attitudinal, and style adverbials in particular are most frequent in epistemic stands, adverbials, that's a mistake, are most frequently in Shakespeare's plays. Now, what I want to do in the future, I would like to relate stands, adverbials in Shakespeare to speakers. Now, what I haven't done yet, I haven't checked all my forms in the different corpora, which means there are still quite a few forms I have to check in the other corpora as well, for indeed, and the by my construction, I started with the most frequently occurring forms, but that's something I still have to do. And for Shakespeare, of course, relate that to speaker and hearer. I think there is something going on with regard to the Shakespeare database. I was able to align some of the forms to the speakers, and it seems to be the case that they are most frequently used by characters from lower social ranks. But that is something I have to verify. Of course, related phenomena need to be investigated. Related phenomena, sometimes you find stands, adverbials co-occurring with particular vocative forms, with particular speech acts. That is something I still want to do. And just to finish this off, what I have said before in terms of the methodological framework, it's combining the modern new ways of new historical linguistics, corpus linguistics, and so on, also with the more traditional philological or hermeneutic work, reading plus then checking different forms in corpora, trying to establish their functions, including the context as such. So to finish this off, let me then have your express opinion. Thank you. Questions?
I have about 5 questions, but I think you should go first.
I knew you would. Come on. You have to go first.
But I have to go first. Okay, well, one of my questions was what the difference between a stans adverbial and an exclamation really is. I mean, because
or interjection.
By my sword, good heavens, mm-hmm. alas,
mm-hmm. Yeah.
Lo and behold. I mean, where's the difference?
Well, I mean, for something like alas, I haven't included that because I still think, even though some pragmatic markers are said to have no longer semantic content, so therefore I've excluded alas and oh, swoons, meaning God's wounds, for example. I haven't included those. Yeah?
They express attitude, don't they?
Yeah, they do, as pragmatic markers. Yeah, they do, as pragmatic markers. But for stands, adverbials, as I said, I followed Biber in this kind of categorization of indicating epistemic stance, style, or attitudinal, And therefore, they still have, although it was sometimes difficult, because you're right, sometimes they were so frozen that to some extent they acted like interjections as such, definitely. The line is difficult, but I didn't include obvious interjections like alas, for example. I didn't include that. Of course, they express attitude. But that's why I said what I used is the definition of stance adverbials, which can express attitude, let's put it this way. But it's of course, I mean, that you could also say these are pragmatic markers, and therefore I have to include all of these as well, plus the common clauses. I also excluded the common clauses because they are so frequent, and I just started with those that were not something like I say, I think, and so on. A starting point. But you're right. I mean.
Okay, come on. I broke the ice. Your turn now.
And of course, including them would mean different quantitative results. Clap, of course. And they are high frequency items as well. No questions?
Do you want to go first? And then you behind. Okay.
I was actually wondering the whole talk whether you checked for the social classes that people in the place present, because couldn't it be that these things are more common in the communities, because communities have more people from lower ranks?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's. Yeah, I mean, I said at the end that this is what I'm going to do. I have to check the different characters who use these stance adverbials, and I've done that. I've sort of done it, very small case studies, and it's actually the case that with regard to this case study, characters from lower social classes use more stance adverbials. Yes, that's true. But I wanted to try to establish a set before. But with regard to the comedies, of course, it's there is this temptation to say it's more speech-like, it's faster, and that's why somebody suggested to me as well, perhaps there is more prose in the comedies than verse. Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. With the comedy result I had. Yeah, that's something I still have to do. I haven't done that yet. Because I wanted to start with a set first. Mm-hmm. Between grammaticalization and
pragmatic.
Oh, okay. So, okay, no problem. So, pragmatics is the analysis, or one definition could be, is the analysis of language in use, in context. Yeah? And we can do that, of course, for modern English, and to see how we act with one another, what kind of forms of address we use, what kind of speech acts we use, and how the addressee reacts to these speech acts, and so on. So that's the analysis of language in use, in context. And sometimes even social factors come into play, and so on. So age, gender, and so on. This is then the socio-pragmatic dimension coming into this. Now, grammaticalization is a process that tries to capture how language changes and how particular items, like Jizu, for example, are abbreviated into G and then become almost semantically empty, so don't have the meaning they used to have before, and then are used for interactive purposes, to have an expression or to be to interject, to say, gee, I don't like that, or something like that. Did I explain that correctly? Kind of? Or did something?
We did a whole lecture on grammaticalization, basically, the one just before this.
Oh, okay.
Actually, some people would probably disagree with this. I didn't talk about this.
Mm-hmm.
You've now given a grammaticalization path towards a discourse marker.
Yeah. But there are others, of course.
For some people, discourse markers are not grammatical features, therefore we cannot talk of grammaticalization.
They talk about pragmaticalization,
which.
I think, is close to our subjectification in a
exactly.
way, and intersubjectification. But,
mm-hmm. one could take a broader view of grammaticalization and basically say any development from a lexical
sorry.
Item, from a lexical item to a, to a grammatical
to grammar. Yeah.
In your context, of course, that's part of it.
That's part of the game, because and that's sometimes misleading, I think, when you talk about grammaticalization, because you have a lexical item first and then a grammatical item, and that grammatical item can have pragmatic function, which I find sometimes difficult to understand.
But I left that out for the lecture because it's actually quite confusing.
Yeah, it is. Oh, okay. Mm-hmm.
Actually,
these few examples I got, and that's why I relate to what you've mentioned before as well, relate to who says it. And many of the not many, I mean, that's the wrong word, but for most of the few examples I have found, these were spoken by people from lower social classes. That's all I can say about their kind of stylistic function. Yeah. But I mean, it's very tricky in a way to try for or to aim for quantitative features as well, reliable quantitative results with these small or with items that don't occur so frequently in a way, and where, because it's a pragmatic phenomenon, you can even a definition is problematic in itself, but you have to start, or I wanted to start somewhere, let's put it this way. Okay.
Well, I've got kind of a nasty question, I guess.
Go ahead.
About, not directed towards you in particular, but towards the whole field of historical pragmatics.
Mm-hmm.
You make the point that, well, perhaps you didn't have that many instances of a particular type in the data because perhaps the scribe didn't write it down. Doesn't that mean that the kind of data that we are forced to use is necessarily unreliable?
Yeah.
And therefore the whole idea of doing historical pragmatics is doomed from the outset?
Yeah. I mean, from your point of view, I think I have to say yes, you're right. From my point of view, being an historian as well, I would have to say that's all we've got.
I'm not saying that this is my view.
No, I would have to say that's all we've got, and at least we have something, and perhaps from a stylistic point of view, I probably also have to say that I also believe in low-frequency items in a way, and the stylistic impact they have, but I mean, that's all we've got. In a way, in terms of data, and at least we have some corpora, historical corpora, which, try to clone some of the methods of corpus construction, for example, for modern corpora. I don't see that as too much of a problem in a way, because at least that's something is there we can work with. But perhaps that's too simple an answer. I don't know. What a valid question. And that's perhaps also one reason why most recently some even historical pragmaticians who have worked with corpora quite frequently have said, is it actually necessary to have figures and so on to illustrate pragmatic change? But perhaps it is. Oh, sorry.
Mm-hmm. Another question. I hope I can explain correctly so that you understand me. I mean, you said that you're a historian as well, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, and you found out that epistemic
stance and verbal
adverbials are more used, at least in Shakespeare's
mm-hmm.
plays,
mm-hmm.
By low class characters or
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's my hunch. I haven't tested that,
yeah.
But
no, I kind of believe it. But
yeah.
I mean, don't you think that at least one of the explanations might be that back then people lived in a strongly hierarchical society, so people coming from a low class were not trusted at all, so
mm-hmm.
language was their own weapon they
mm-hmm.
had, for example, in front of court to protect
mm-hmm.
themselves,
mm-hmm.
and of course they had to use this certainty
mm-hmm.
words to terms
mm-hmm.
to get ahead in life or
yeah. Yeah, I see what you mean, and I think that's a starting point, I think, for an explanation as well. When Shakespeare wrote his plays, we already have something that is called social mobility. So there were quite a few who tried to move up the social ladder as such. So what I would perhaps slightly twist or turn your line of argumentation by saying that they also tried to imitate what they thought would be right and therefore try to indicate sincerity and so on as such, because they assumed there were certain norms around. That's something else I still want to do. There are quite a few rhetorical handbooks around for the period when Shakespeare wrote his plays to see whether there are some comments there on normative usages as such. Yeah, but I think that's a starting point.
In Albania, I always listen to people, and it is really true that they, the lower the classes, the more
mm-hmm.
they use this
mm-hmm.
Kind of words. It is very common
to ensure themselves.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And but with intellectuals, you seldom find it.
Hmm. Yeah. Although, generally speaking, for modern English, of course, these stance adverbials are very frequent in spoken discourse as such. What I don't know of any studies that relate that to social structure, something like that, or communities of practice or something like that, but yeah, would have to be checked. Ah. For the sake of
injections, and you just said you
interjections, or for the sake of
what you exclude? I think I got the wrong name.
Excluded these interjections,
yeah.
Like alas, for example, and also common clauses, like I say, for example. Well, I mean, the first function is to express attitude in the sense that these epistemic stands adverbials express the sincerity, or at least the superficial sincerity, of what is said. Like, by my sword, Beatrice, thou lovest me. I really believe that. You know, you love me as such. And as I said, these constructions, you don't need them to have a grammatical sentence. That's always the starting point, in a way, to is it grammatical or not, so you can leave it out. But with that, you have an additional force. And with regard to functions, you could say, yeah, it has got an interpersonal function because it signals to the hearer, yes, this is what I actually, this is what my interlocutor actually means. It's, well, superficially speaking, first of all, it's sincere. There are more nuances in Shakespeare than that, but still, that's the first starting point. Sometimes they can even have, you know, they can even indicate a topic switch as well, but I've left that out as well. Yeah, so that's the and they are as such pragmatic markers, or have a pragmatic function as well. If you have something like by my beard and so on, they carry meaning as well, in a way. They are not as frozen forms as by my troth and by my faith, for example. Yeah?
Adverbials that were more related to religion, and then later they were replaced by adverbials that, sense adverbials that were less related to religion. Do you think this was reflected in the, or did you find evidence that this was reflected in the actual use of these adverbials, or it just happens in the written text?
Yeah, I mean, when you refer to actual usage, you mean spoken everyday conversation? Well, we don't, in a way, don't have records.
Or in the letters?
Well, in the letters, you most of the forms that occur were the frozen forms by my troth and by my faith. And this kind of construction seemed to be at least, or taken up again by Shakespeare in a way. And I didn't mean the earlier plays and the later plays, but the different editions of the plays or early printings you have got. So for the earlier printings, you still have by my faith, by my troth, and so on. And in the first folio from 1623, then, you have these replaced by truly, so by more neutral forms in a way that don't have this religious base, but might have the same function, referring to this epistemic function as such. Well, I mean, that is always the question, whether the way how Shakespeare wrote his plays, or how the plays were transcribed to us through the early printings, reflects how this people actually spoke at the time. Again, for me, I would just say this is the text we've got. It's somewhat constructed spoken discourse, which has, as Sinclair said, has to be included in an analysis of language as well. So, yeah, I guess that's what would be my answer to that. It's taking norms from the time and playing with them, using them for a creative purpose. Perhaps I would go as far as that. Yeah, is that probably not a satisfactory answer, but yeah.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.